Film Nerds Unlimited. Lo-fi movie conversations with high-quality movie connoisseurs. Ben Flanagan of AL.com. Matt Scalise, editor of FilmNerds.com.
Ben.
Matt.
Frozen in terror. I just got out of seeing It, which we, I guess, spoiler alert in advance, as we always do on Film Nerds Unlimited, but a movie we might come to know one day as It Part 1 or Chapter 1 or whatever. But I have to say, you know, I kind of have kept myself relatively fresh going into this movie. I saw one really great trailer for it and was kind of sold all the way. And, you know, I don't feel like they oversaturated us with marketing for this movie. There's no real known stars that I've been seeing, you know, blitzing out there in the media. And yet, somehow, this has become one of the surprising box office hits of 2017. Just an overwhelmingly surprising box office opening for this movie. I think it did something like double what the studio was expecting from it. So, you know, my first instinct, Ben, is to say, I think this is obviously a movie that people were ready for, whether the studio was fully aware of it or not. Something about this movie, even before people had a chance to see it, it was very broadly appealing just as a concept to people. So I guess to start going into it, before we give our thoughts on the movie, Ben, what are your thoughts on this sort of huge, stunner box office performance from this movie, and how did that come about? How did this movie turn into a $100 million opener?
I don't know. I really don't. I mean, it obviously hit a pretty enormous sweet spot here between summer and the fall. The summer pretty much ended a couple of weeks ago with, I would say Logan Lucky, but that was kind of a flop, and I'm forgetting what movie came out the same weekend or what came out the week after to close out August. I mean, the summer's been over now for a while, and I guess people kind of have a hankering to go to the movie theater and see something good because, as has been reported by many outlets, this has been a pretty steep drop-off box office-wise in 2017. So for something like It to come along and just dominate the way that it has in such surprising fashion, I mean, it made $123 million in its first weekend. I had no idea that it would do those numbers. It's on a budget of $35 million. I know horror movies tend to do really well, but
That's crazy, though. I haven't researched it. I can't even think of a horror movie that's open to that kind of number.
No.
Ever.
No.
I mean, not that I'm aware of.
No, certainly not. I mean, you're talking about when you say horror movies do well, you're talking about movies that eventually make $100 million on small-scale budgets, and not movies that make $100-something million on their first weekend. And look, it's been a while since Stephen King has really had a story translate to the big screen like in a way that's been as widely anticipated and publicized as this movie It. And he obviously had an insane run during the 70s, 80s, and 90s where you seemingly got a Stephen King movie every single year, if not multiple movies a year. And I think we're going to get something like that again here in the next 5 to 10 years. There's going to be a slew of Stephen King adaptations and reboots, readaptations, reimaginings, et cetera. He's going to be rolling in it again. So I don't really know how to explain it other than people like horror, people like good horror, and people where I guess have been underwhelmed with what the offering that Hollywood has given them in 2017 thus far. And it's not like people don't want to see movies. They want to see certain movies, and It happened to be one of those certain movies.
Well, one thing that you mentioned there about the Stephen King appeal. The funny thing is there was another Stephen King adaptation this summer, and it was a huge flop. It was a disaster. And I think part of it is the fact that it wasn't, it didn't hit the sweet spot. I think Stephen King, look, I've recently gotten into reading Stephen King's books. I haven't read it yet, but there is certainly an appeal to the sort of nostalgic feel, because Stephen King was a big part of the culture of the 1980s. And as we know, that's a huge thing right now in TV, in movies. People are making a lot of money off of appealing to 80s nostalgia. And, you know, I think it's impossible to talk about this movie without bringing that up as a huge part of it. I think they didn't shy away from it in the marketing. And, you know, I've heard a bunch of people, Ben, bring up that this movie may have capitalized off of that wave. But the fact is, this is a part of, I wonder if you have any positive or negative feelings about that. It seems to me there's sort of a weird backlash that I get a sense of sometimes when people talk about nostalgia, almost as if it's a negative thing or that it's a new thing that people haven't been doing forever, including, you know, 100 years ago, people were nostalgic about things and people created things to appeal to that. How does the sort of 80s nostalgia wave rub you in general right now?
I'm kind of in the middle, I guess. And what's weird is that you've got a lot of people who there's been a backlash with the 80s nostalgia thing on certain projects and certain movies. And the same people who participate in the backlash are praising things like It and Stranger Things, which are just chock full of 80s references, and they really shove them in your face. And I think It is the same thing. I mean, there are so many references to reinforce that this takes place in the late 80s that I got a little sick of it as it was going on. I mean, just to rattle off a few here, Matt, like I thought it was everywhere. You had stuff like the movies Batman and Lethal Weapon 2 being on a local theater marquee. You had a Nightmare on Elm Street 5 poster. You had New Kids on the Block referenced a couple of times. There's a kid that wears an Airwolf t-shirt. You have multiple instances where you hear the sound effects from a digital watch. They're playing arcade games. There's boom boxes. I really thought it was everywhere. So, I don't know, like, in some spurts it was subtle, but I think for the most part it was kind of shoved in my face. They made sure that I knew it was the 80s, even after the title card at the very beginning told me it was in the 80s. But like you said, that's obviously an attempt to cash in on this bug that people obviously have and this appetite people have for that stuff.
Well, you know, I mean, what's funny is in the 80s, we were talking about the exact same thing, and the wave of nostalgia was for things in the 60s, and you had a ton of movies set in that era with lots of music drops in those movies from the 60s and, you know, clothing and cultural references and all that kind of stuff. I think it really is a perpetual part of pop culture always, is looking back about 20 or 30 years. But that said, Ben, you know, I think one of the big reasons why you would do that with an adaptation of It, which is a story that is not set in the 80s, really, it's set in the 60s. It's a book that obviously came out at that period of time and is a part of 80s culture itself. So let's go ahead and get into the story itself. I really have not read, I've never read the book. I have seen the miniseries, but it's been so long that I couldn't have told you many of the narrative beats of it. To me, put all of the nostalgia stuff aside, to me, just as a story, man, it was really effective and it works, especially, I think, the first, you know, three quarters of the movie. I think you have to wrap up a story like this eventually, and it does not have a traditional horror ending, I think, you know, and in part because it's not the actual end of the story. But this movie, you know, has a pretty heroic ending. It has, you know, it's close to a happy ending as I guess you could get for a horror story like this. But really, the first three quarters of it, to me, there's so much suspense. There's, you know, I think the effects are used really sparingly and really well. You're not beaten over the head with it. I walk away from this movie with the most is the villain is a really unique character in the way that he's played and performed and designed. I really think that there's a lot of directions you could go with this kind of character that could tip it to either just a too run-of-the-mill monster or too silly, you know, too much in the Freddy Krueger direction. And I think that they found a really interesting balance here that I think they have from the very first scene of the movie, the initial appearance with the little brother. Man, I felt like I was really watching them nail something unique in that scene.
You know, I think I should preface this by saying, like, I did my best not to compare this just beat for beat with the 1990 miniseries, which
right.
I saw when I was a child. You know, like
I did too. Yeah,
yeah. I didn't have a great I couldn't tell you everything that happened in that miniseries. So I'm actually in the middle of rewatching it right now. And look, that gave me like legit nightmares back
oh,
when
yeah.
I was a kid. Like it was serious business, man. Like the Pennywise the Clown and Tim Curry's performance and just the imagery throughout that whole thing. And I can't even tell you if I saw the whole thing as a kid, to be honest with you, but whatever it did, it really did a number on me as a kid, and it affected me. So I would look back on it as being one of the scariest things I had ever seen. And now that I'm in the middle of a rewatch, you know, almost, you know, 27 years later, it's not as scary, you know, it's a little hokey, and it certainly has its moments, to be sure. And Tim Curry is really good, but I don't know, there's a little bit of nostalgia there and a little bit of revisionist history, I guess, on my part in terms of, like, looking back and remembering what I could about it. That being said, I think it's fine, and so I think I went into this with a little anger, like, why do we need another remake? Well, I mean, look, this is the first ever theatrical adaptation of it, so it's fair game, right? Like, this is the first time it's been in a movie theater, so it's fine with me. But I don't know, Matt. Like I thought it was fine when you said let's get around to the story right now. I wish you had been there at the beginning of the movie when I was watching it to tell the movie to do the same thing, because I felt like it took about an hour to finally tell some story. I felt like it was all kind of show and no tell. Until about an hour into it, when these kids finally come together and say, oh, hey, you're going through this too? I'm having nightmares and visions and whatever, and I'm seeing the clown too. Oh, okay, that's like an hour into the movie, man. And this movie, I think, you know,
it's
not,
long
not
for
to,
a horror movie, for
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, I don't mean to be, you know, give it a shallow criticism, but it's too long. I thought it was way too long. There's a point in this movie where there's this, like, sun-baked haunted house showdown with the Pennywise clown. And once that was over, it felt kind of over. The movie felt kind of over, and then it just keeps going on and on and on, and we get this another just big climactic showdown with the clown again that just felt repetitive. So I think structurally there's some issues here, and that was obviously going to be a big challenge going into adapting this into a two-hour movie in terms of whose perspective you were going to tell it from, leaving the adults out exclusively, which is obviously, you know, going to be told in the next movie. But, I mean, you got to give him credit. I mean, it seems like a difficult thing to adapt. And you know, I think he did well enough. And I think that there are a bunch of well-constructed horror scenes all, like, riddled throughout this movie. And I like the fact that it's an R-rated movie anchored by kids, obviously in the vein of something like another Stephen King story, Stand By Me. But I don't know if I even love the kids. I think I like half the kids.
I do think that the kids were all well differentiated. I think some of the performances of the kids are a lot better than others. But I think one thing to me that's a strength is that I can tell them apart. And it's a pretty big band of kids. So I think they all had good, solid moments of character development. I think some more than others. But, you know, I think to me, you know, I'm with you that on there being kind of a double climax of this movie. I think it was weird that it feels like they beat him, the in the yeah. as you said, like the well lit Kitchen Showdown. I might be making up that it was in a kitchen, but that, you know, that encounter, it kind of feels like they won. And the fact that there's really another half hour at least in the movie after that, you know, I think that there are a lot of other beats for the characters that happen in that second showdown. That's probably a lot more of why they drew it out like that. But I do think that, you know, what kept me hanging on in it is that every sort of appearance of the villain, the stakes felt high to me. I some of that's because I didn't go into it knowing that all the kids are going to make it to the end, so I didn't really know. I felt like there was legitimate suspense there. I think that especially really what I would consider the three lead kids, I cared a lot about them, and I thought their characters were drawn well enough and the performances were good that I did care about them and wanted to see what happened with them. I really think when you're going to have with even one that's got a lot more going on with it than maybe your typical Blumhouse monster movie, this movie to me, they all have to hinge on, is it actually interesting when the scary thing is on screen? And to me, this really, any scene where Pennywise was more than just a quick little cameo peeking out from behind the corner was really fascinating for me to watch. And I thought, I guess this guy's name is Bill Skarsgård.
Yeah.
That plays him. I don't think I've ever seen him in anything before. I think the character was just so well designed and the voice and mannerisms worked really well for me. It's very different than Tim Curry, but I liked it a lot, and I thought it was this very unsettling in a kind of unique way.
You know, I think I agree with you just because of, like, what they did with the character, like, physically, the way he moved, the things he did. I'll agree with you. I thought that his, like, actual appearance and design was a bit like Horror Clown 101. And like, you just, you know, he's got mean-looking eyes. People are scared of clowns. I thought that, at least the Tim Curry Pennywise looked like a real clown in the miniseries other than his scary teeth. Where, like, and you know, look, it's a horror movie, and he's going to be scary at some point. But, I mean, I guess what I'm looking for is, like, how are you, like, isn't part of this to sort of, I don't know, isn't it meant to, like, sort of, like, lure kids, like, bait kids, where it's like, why would you ever go near the 2017 Pennywise? He's just always, always scary looking.
I don't think he's supposed to lure them. I think he is supposed to scare them. I mean, I feel like that was kind of the gist of it from the beginning, is he wants to make you afraid. And, you know, I think one thing that making the movie in 2017 gives you an advantage of is you can really play off of the fact that it's actually not a clown. It's a monster. It's a weird sort of otherworldly monster, and you don't get to see that right away. It has to play out over the course of the movie.
Yeah, and I think they kind of cleverly sort of gave you a clever reason as to why Pennywise was a clown, or why they were all seeing the clown, because, I mean, you never see the Richie character played by the kid from Stranger Things, who I hated at first, like, hated. You never really see his visions the same way you do the other kids, and then later you understand that he admits, like, his big, like, deep, dark fear is clowns. So, I guess at that point, understand why Pennywise has manifested as, you know, manifested in this way as a clown is appearing to all these kids that way. I don't know if that's really how it's supposed to line up. And just, like, speaking of the kids, like, in obviously the big heart of the movie here is this losers club, these, what, seven or so kids that all sort of band together. And it's important that these kids all have good chemistry and that they are good actors, because they carry the movie, you know. And I think, for the most part, they are. I thought the Ben character was outstanding.
Yeah.
The sort of, like, chubby outsider kid who has no friends until he runs into the Beverly character. I thought the Beverly character was really good. I thought Eddie, sort of the hypochondriac kid, was really good. I couldn't believe that they found a 9-year-old who was a dead ringer for Mitch Albom, but they did. But I thought he was really good. So I think for the most part, you know, these kids were strong actors. I thought the Mike character and Stan character were next to useless in the movie in terms of, like, the attention that the story in the film gave them.
Yeah, I definitely think Mike is shortchanged. I think the – what did you say the other kid's name is?
Stan.
Yeah, I mean, I think he actually gets a lot of development. I don't really love the performance, and I don't think they give him enough redeeming moments. He's kind of too much of a drag on the rest of the group. But Mike is a cool character with a good backstory, and I think the thing they probably didn't really work hard enough to sell me on is, like, how did he, you know, where's the chemistry with the other kids beyond, hey, we happened to run into him in the woods and kind of helped him out. Like, I would have liked something more than that.
Yeah, I don't think that the director, whose name is, I believe, Andy Muschietti, I think is how it's pronounced.
Something like that.
Muschietti.
Not Muschietti.
I don't think he managed the roster all that well. I mean, there's a lot to work with there, and you've got your central characters with the Bill and Bev and Ben characters who are sort of like the heart of the order there. But, you know, Ben, I thought that you said shortchanged. I thought he just got totally screwed out of the screen time he had earned during the final third of the movie. Outside of this really super cheesy Hollywood moment where he kisses the Bev character, like, out of her stupor that she's in towards the end. And this really, I thought, was kind of a hokey, that the second showdown that we get towards the end, which felt like the most very, very Hollywood-y type thing that didn't really, I think, fit the tone of the rest of the movie. But, so I was disappointed that you know, he fell out of it. But, again, for the most part, I think the kids are pretty good. It's just, I don't know, man. Like, I don't know what's rubbing me the wrong way about this, because I think the movie pretty deftly explores, I guess, sort of the themes that Stephen King was going for in terms of this loss of innocence, or these legitimate childhood fears that many people that we all have faced at some point. The, you know, in the kids' cases, in the kids in this movie's case, their fear of adults, where you have all these adult characters who are very they're negative characters. Like, I can't think of one adult character in the movie that has a positive impact
on one
of the kids, which is obviously a very important theme that Stephen King is trying to hit at. I don't know what that says about him in his childhood, but I know that this is a really very personal book that he wrote, but I liked a lot of what that explored. I liked the scenes where the kids were interacting with the adults. It told me a lot about their characters. They were very well staged, very well acted, but, you know, they had to abandon that at some point, I guess, just so they could focus on the kids and their many battles with Pennywise.
I think the bully does a nice job too. I mean, he's effectively horrible.
Yeah, is it any coincidence that Pennywise and the bully both have giant foreheads?
And kind of mullet too, both.
Yeah.
Yeah, the mullet is the immediate sign of evil in a movie set in the 80s.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know, man. Like, this movie has, again, there are a lot of really, like, awesome, just straight-up horror scenes. I mean, the director is obviously gifted at staging stuff like this. And, I mean, there's one scene in the movie and, like, one just, like, visual moment that they just nail. And it's, like, super scary. It involves the kids, like, hanging out in a garage watching this projector, you know, where this projector sort of takes a life of its own. And then Pennywise appears, and I won't spoil just how he does, but, man, that was, to me, the coolest visual sort of, like, gag slash scare of the movie.
I think there were a lot of good, even non-scare related shots that just kind of struck me at certain moments of the movie. There's actually one towards the end of the movie when we kind of think at this point in the story that Pennywise is gone. He's gone into orbit, like hibernation at this point. And really, the way he reemerges is he visits the bully and kind of stirs him up. And there's a really cool moment where he's just kind of sitting out in a field and he starts to hear some noises, and there's this big, very cinematic, you know, push in on him. I think he did a really good job. I think I like that this movie doesn't have the palette of the only other movie that I'm aware of this director's made is a movie called Mama, which was a pretty good horror movie. I'm not going to say it was extraordinary, but I liked a lot about it, and I thought that it had some really good performances in it, and like this movie, it was a horror movie that was actually sympathetic towards its characters. It wasn't anxious to visit murder and mayhem on people. I think it was more of a if you can be one, it's a lighter horror movie. And I think that movie looked like most cheap horror movies do, where everything is black and blue and gray. And one thing that I think I like about it is that it didn't look like that. There's a lot of oranges and golds and yellows in this movie. And I think some of that fits into the nostalgia play. But
yeah,
it's an interesting look for a horror movie, though, and I like it. I think it certainly made it feel more like I was watching a movie that happened to be scary in parts than, hey, you are here to see the latest, you know, $30 million horror movie somebody cranked out.
Well, so where does this stand in terms of Stephen King adaptations? Because there's been, like, literally 40. And a quick note on that, in its first week, it became the second all-time highest grossing Stephen King adaptation. The only thing it's under right now, which it's probably going to crush overnight, is The Green Mile. That was one. So,
isn't,
like,
that funny? That made more than Shawshank Redemption did, even though it kind of feels like they only made it because of Shawshank. But
oh yeah,
I think that what it did. I have not read it. I've read a good bit of Stephen King. So to me, what I would say about it is it feels more. It is closer to matching the tone of an 80s, 70s Stephen King novel than anything else that I can really think of. And I commend it for that. I think tonally is what they really did right. There's a narratively, Stephen King books have rarely been made successful movies for a reason. And it's because they're huge, complex, messy narratives with a million characters in them. You know, Stephen King has more books that people have called unfilmable than almost anybody that I'm aware of. And they're right most of the time, you know? I think what they did right about this was the tone. And I think Stephen King's done, you know, people have taken his work and made great movies before, but they didn't necessarily feel exactly like the source material. And that's fine. You know, I think the adaptation that he probably likes the least, or one of the least, is the greatest movie ever adapted from his work, and one of the greatest movies of all time, The Shining. But, you know, I read The Dead Zone recently. That is a really, really good movie. The book is really good, too, but they're very different. I think what you had in the 80s was this period of time where really, really talented filmmakers were picking up ideas and concepts from his books and making really interesting movies out of them. And that kind of stopped for a while. I don't know if it was because people were giving more deference than they should have to Stephen King himself. But I think that may have been a part of it. And I don't know you and I both feel confident that anytime a movie makes money like this, there's going to be an overreaction in Hollywood, and everybody's going to try to make Stephen King adaptations.
Yep, it's
and
coming.
The question is, are you going to go out and hire really good filmmakers and say, hey, you want to take a crack at something Stephen King? Or are you going to say, let's option all of it, and we'll find the people who will do the job for us, and we'll make it as close to the book as we possibly can. Because that's probably not the way to go. And that's probably what people were doing more of in the late 80s and 90s with Stephen King adaptations. I don't know. I would say that certainly the second possibility is the more likely given what we know about studios. But I think it would be really cool if all of a sudden we got some of the top filmmakers with unique voices and we said, take whatever you want. Go pick out a Stephen King book and make a movie out of it. And if you want to change something, change something.
Yeah, and, you know, people did that. Like, we had Rob Reiner has made Stephen King movies to really, like, with successful results. You know, Stanley Kubrick made a Stephen King movie. David Cronenberg made a Stephen King movie. So we've had that, but we're about to get more. I think it's going to be a mix of what you're talking about. I think we're going to get a new Pet Sematary movie. I think it's very possible we could get a new Shining movie, if you can believe that. I think they might even try to reboot Carrie again. I think we're going to get a lot of Stephen King here in the next, again, 5 to 10 years or so. Some of it wanted, some of it unwanted. And look, I mean, it's not like all of these movies were perfect, like you said. I mean, a lot of these novels have been quote unquote unfilmable. That has been realized in the form of things like Stinner and maybe like Sleepwalkers and The Mangler and these movies that just nobody necessarily wanted to see, but they had Stephen King's name on them, so maybe they'll make a buck. It turns out they didn't. But look, in terms of it, where it stands in the realm of these Stephen King adaptations, I think it's right there in the middle. I think it's fine. Is it as good as Misery? No. Like, is it as good as The Shining or Carrie or The Dead Zone? No, it's not. But, you know, perhaps that was a tall order. Maybe it's just right under that with some of those other adaptations. Maybe it is. It's better than Thinner. It's probably better than Children of the Corn.
Maximum Overdrive, the movie that was about trucks that kill people.
Hey, man, take it easy on Emilio Estevez. So, yeah, you know, it's good. I think I might be being a little bit too hard on it.
I definitely am more positive on it than you are. And I think it's, again, I acknowledge some of the narrative messiness that you're talking about.
Yeah.
What I come away with more than anything was I had a good time watching it, and the tone was right. It felt like the experience of reading a Stephen King novel.
Yeah.
And I think it looked great too, which is important to me too. And I mean, it's so rare that you actually leave a horror movie saying that looked really good, you know?
Yeah. I think I agree with you. I just, again, like you said, it's just like, I think you're right. Tonally, it's there. Again, it has everything that I think you want in a good horror movie. But there's just something that just didn't totally coalesce for me story-wise. And I have not read it. So I'm not speaking as somebody who's like a diehard fan of the novel, which I know is dense and has a lot of moving parts. And the director obviously made changes where he saw fit, and this is what I've since heard from the director's mouth. This movie is Stephen King approved. He liked it a lot. So if it's good enough for Stephen King, I'm sure it should be good enough for Stephen King's ardent fans out there. But yeah, I can't like fully articulate what it is that rubbed me the wrong way outside of it. I just didn't think the story itself was very strong. I thought it took a little too long to get going in terms of fleshing that stuff out. There's a lot of really great ideas, and there are a lot of really awesome set pieces and visuals, like you mentioned. So I can definitely recommend it.
I'm with you. Ben, let me ask you this before we wrap up. Since we have now acknowledged there is most definitely an oncoming wave, a tidal wave that we will not be able to stop of Stephen King adaptations, Name for me one director you really want to see one from.
Oh, God, a director?
Yeah.
I'll tell you what, man. Give me a David Fincher, Stephen King.
Yeah, I was going to say David Fincher. And it would be very different from probably any book, it would feel tonally different. It would have to, but I think it would be cool to see.
Yeah, works for me. I mean, I know that you're you'd be totally fine with him abandoning zombie sequels in favor of a Stephen King movie.
If you really, really want to make a zombie story, David Fincher, we're
I
want to
see
waiting.
David Fincher's Pet Sematary 3.
I was going to say, I'm still waiting on an actual Salem's Lot movie. Not a Rob Lowe TV movie, but an actual movie of Salem's Lot. I think David Fincher would nail that.
Hey, man, R.I.P. Toby Hooper on that.
Yeah, note. Yeah.
Cool, man. Well, I guess people should check it out.
Thanks, man. We definitely will end on that terrible joke.
All right.
All right. Thanks, dude.
All right, man.
All right. See ya.
Yeah.
For more from the Film Nerds, go to filmnerds.com and aspectradioshow.com.